Coming up, work at the Ness of Brodgar continues.
I'm trying not to get too excited, but we just found a tiny, tiny little bit of stone that looks like it might be decorated stone. So little crisscrosses okay. on it.
You'll get an update on the archaeology being done at Jamestown in the US, one of the first places settled by Europeans in the New World.
And there's an appearance in Orkney from my favourite internet word nerd.
Yes, hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. Helen's at home. I am still for another week here at the Ness of Brodgar on Orkney, this amazing Neolithic site where excavations have been ongoing to try and get to the bottom of those remarkable geophysics results that were discovered by Time Team's John Gator. I mean, you've probably seen the image by now, haven't you? But if you haven't, go and seek it out kind of everywhere online. A really obvious circular structure in the data. But is it a stone circle? Is it a double curb cairn? Is it a Second World War gun emplacement? A folly? We're only going to find out by digging it, and that is what's been happening.
And how is John, Martin?
How is John? Well, I was with him in the pub last night, actually, and we had a very, very nice evening, as you might imagine you do with John, in his backyard as well, because he lives here now on Orkney. I would describe him as being in good spirits but stressed, because this is his baby. You know, he really, really wants this dig to go well. He wants everything to go right. In fact, I'm looking out of the window now from the kitchen of the little house, which is right next to the dig, which is where I am at the moment and where I was last week as well. It's where I've kind of set up camp. I can see him right over in the distance speaking to one of his geophysics students, and they're just, I think they're poring over data or something. They're looking very intently at a piece of paper. So he's still working, still wanting to make sure that all the results are right and everything goes as well as it can be.
Yes, because it is a big responsibility, isn't it? If you drag the whole of Time Team up, I mean, of course, at the Ness of Brodgar, you can be absolutely sure that wonderful things are going to come up, but you still have that responsibility to have told people how they should set it up to ensure that you've got everything you need. The responsibility rests on his shoulders more than it will do for any other site. So I can imagine he's both delighted and stressed.
Yeah, oh, without a doubt, yeah.
Now, Martin, you've been on site for a little while now, haven't you? And you've been watching the excavation as it's been happening, meeting the archaeologists who are braving the weather, the cold, the wind and the rain, to get to the bottom of the mystery of that circular feature.
I'm Jim Rylett, and I'm a supervisor here at the Ness. I've worked here for, I think this is 16 years now. I'm sort of quite used to digging little bits of the Ness and trying to work out what's going on.
And what is going on, Jim?
Well, I'm still trying to work that out at the moment. Right in front of us, we've got this arc of stones coming around, which we're now fairly confident is the foundation of a building, sort of subcircular, not quite true circle. There's very little of it left, so it doesn't look like the prettiest building you've seen, but that's because the stones are sat in this little tiny trench. They were meant to be the foundation, they were meant to be buried, so nobody would ever see the fact that they look a bit random and they're a bit sort of scattered around, because the really nice walls would have been built on top of them. And we've had successive episodes of ploughing over here. We've had prehistoric ploughing, we've had medieval or post-medieval ploughing, we've had 20th century ploughing with tractors. So that's removed quite a lot of stuff. But also, it's clear from the fact that there's not lots of stone in the modern plough soil that this building was demolished in the Neolithic. They took most of it away. And that's quite a common thing across the Ness. We've dug many of the buildings on there. This one's actually Structure 44 now. It's got a number officially, a name. And many of the buildings we've dug, they've taken apart to recycle the building materials. So probably the most valuable building material for them would have been the timber that was used to support the roofs. But after that, good stonework is taken away, because if it's already quarried, it makes life easier building your next building than going, you know, abandoning it all and then going off and quarrying a whole load more stone, because they're quite big lumps and you've got to carry them a long way from a quarry, sort of thing, potentially. That's why, basically, we've got very little of it left. But we've got enough that we can start telling a story about what's been happening here.
I'm Ben. I'm currently removing what was the basis for a working platform within the midden, outside the structure. So you've got the pinky midden material. It's lovely stuff, but it also gets a bit boggy when it gets wet. So if you want to be doing anything like butchery or something like that, you need to create a sort of working platform out of more consolidated materials. This has been a load of stone and redeposited natural material brought together, pushed into the midden, and then sort of flat working surface made out of that just at the back or to one side of the structure.
So this is just maybe, yeah, a couple of metres outside the circular structure that we can see now really quite clearly defined, and you're working away with the mattock. You look like you're really putting your back into it. How is the work?
It's lovely stuff to mattock when the stones aren't there. When the stones are there, it's a wee bit infuriating. But no, it's good. The midnets material itself is so fine. It's a really nice peat ash material, and it's really lovely to trowel off. And actually, the redeposited natural that's coming off is coming off that surface really well with the mattock. So it's a really actually pleasing bit of work to do. Occasionally you get sort of clusters of stones that make it a wee bit more difficult to get through, but they break apart quite quickly when you hit them.
My name's Tom, and we've been working on this section here. It's basically like a metre wide section. What we're doing is I'm spraying it with water just now, because as soon as we're scraping it back to clean the surface for photographs and planning, it's drying out very quickly. So we just spray it with water, and it brings up the colour of the stones, and it also brings up the colour of the soil itself and shows the different contexts.
And why is it important to do that? Why is it important to see these stones in place, well-defined?
Well, we have to record it. We're going to plan it next, but we're taking some photos just to show where all the stones are in relation to the rest of them and within the context. It's important because for the future, we need to be able to look at things and say, well, OK, that stone was there, and that might have been relevant to perhaps, say, the opening of the building or something. It's really just for future reference. That's all.
And Danny Wootton is here. You've been working on this area of the trench, Danny. What's it been like?
Oh, fun. Yeah, so me and Tom have been in this area and we've been travelling back. But in this part of the section, right towards the end of the trench, we are finding some very flat stones, and they're lying very flat. Above that, we're finding lots of rubbly stones, and they were kind of in all different angles, if you see what I mean, as if they'd just been dumped. But these kind of look a little bit more positioned, and it's kind of looking maybe a little bit more surface-like. So we're wondering if these have been deliberately placed. So what we've done is very carefully cleaned them back. We've stopped digging down and we've just cleaned them back. We've possibly found... I'm trying not to get too excited.
Because, you're desperate too.
Because it might be trowel marks as I was going through cleaning. But we've just found a tiny, tiny little bit of stone that looks like it might be decorated stone. So little crisscrosses
okay.
on it.
No.
I know, right? But the jury's out. We've got to get it all washed up and we're going to have a proper look at it.
Because there haven't been loads of finds from this dig.
No, there haven't been many. And I think that's in contrast to the amount of finds that they've found, like literally about 10 metres away from us over on the site that they've been excavating for 20 years. I think they found all kinds of wonderful finds, didn't they? There's great consternation as to why we're not finding as many finds here. There's suddenly this kind of almost a boundary of like lots of finds and then not so many finds. Is it maybe because this is very early part of the site? Maybe it was cleared, deliberately cleared perhaps, or just kind of, you know, if you start with one house here and then you start making the site over there and it develops, you kind of go, oh, do you know what, there's a nice stone hammer over there, let's reuse this, you know, so you don't just leave everything lying about. Nobody knows what the answer is yet, but that's why I got very excited when I found that little bit of possibly decorated stone, because it's found quite prolifically in the other site that they've been digging for 20 years or so, and it looks very similar. So it's this little, very incised decoration, like a crisscross design. And so I'm quite excited about that. And it's really nice to have this stone surface here as well. So it's really kind of like starting to take shape now. There comes a point in the excavation where you sort of feel this kind of crux of like, oh, everything's kind of starting to make sense. Things are starting to come up. We're starting to find things. And that's when it starts to get really exciting. And then you start worrying because then you start thinking, oh, no, we've only got a few days left.
Oh, it's so great to hear from the site itself and how work is progressing. Now, there's been even more of that for our Time Team members over on Patreon, who have had access to loads of exclusive episodes of Dig Watch. And with that, you get right up close to the excavation and you get to see the progress day by day and hear from some of the people who are making it happen.
Yeah, and one of those people actually has just walked in. Jackie McKinley's here. Hello.
Hiya. I'm just wrestling my way out of my waterproof trousers.
Well, you don't need them now, do you? Because I'm just looking outside and the weather, that's almost sun.
Yes, it's turning glorious now. We get the whole, you've run the whole gamut of the weather up here in the course of 24 hours, but it was a bit dreek this morning. We had lots of wet air, which was a bit uncomfortable. But we can see hoy now, and we use the expression that if you can see hoy, you're probably okay, but if you can't, rain is definitely on its way. And we can see hoy.
I hate to sort of stop you in your tracks here as you're in the middle of kind of running around, but how are things going just a few metres away on site at the moment?
Well, it's going swimmingly. We're adapting what we thought it was. It's slightly different to what we thought it was when we first got here. But we've got a lot of walls that are making a lot of sense. We've got floor levels. We've got evidence for Neolithic ploughing. It's starting to make a lot more sense now we've got through that initial stage of works.
That sounds really exciting, Jackie. The idea of plough marks, I mean, is that really unusual? The preservation must be pretty amazing.
Well, it is, because the reason we can see them is because what they used to do was they would, because the soil's not very rich here, they would spread midden material on it. So it's all sort of red peat ash midden that's been spread around. And then you can see the ard marks, which is the stone plough that they used. They would have an ard is a point, essentially. That's what ard means. You get places that are called ard. The point would be put on a wooden frame and that would be dragged through the ground. And we can see those marks because they have been going through this midden material. And we can see that they're going in several different directions. So we know they use that area for numerous seasons. And that's what enriched the land for them and allowed them to grow some crops.
Gosh, that's absolutely brilliant. I can't wait to hear more about it. It just sounds like there's still remarkably so much there to find.
Well, there is, because although we believe we have got a building, but we're getting new information from this building, which will add to what their understanding of other parts of the nest were, because we're down to foundation levels, which they weren't ever able to get to with the nest, because everything had been built one on top of an earlier building and they could never really get down to the foundation levels. So it's very interesting what we're coming out with there. The odd thing is, in a way, that we have got very few finds as yet. We're getting some work stone, because the classic thing would be that you would use beach pebbles to make hammer stones with and things like that. So we've just had a lovely hammer stone come up not very long ago, actually. But we're not getting a lot of pottery. We're not getting a lot of debris other than the ash midden and the peat ash midden coming up so far. But I think we might be just coming down onto something that's going to be a little bit more fruitful. And of course, that will give us more evidence of not just what the buildings looked like, it's what different buildings we used for. And that's what we need to understand, what different buildings we used for and what different parts within each building was used for. And as we were pointing out earlier, you would get a lot more evidence potentially from outside the buildings, because of course you need the light. You need to have enough light to see to do things like manufacture things, make things. So we're still kind of early days, but we're just getting down onto the really interesting levels now, I think.
At the start of all of this, when all we had to go on was the geophysics image, that amazing circular anomaly, you and I and Helen, the three of us, were talking about it, and you had a bit of a bet on with John Gator. He thought it was a stone circle. You thought it was a double curbed cairn. Are we any closer to then knowing who's won the bet?
We've both lost.
I thought that might be the case. Yeah.
we've both lost, but the shape is more or less correct. But it's more, I would say, a D shape now. And it does look like a building rather than anything else. We've got a continuous foundation level of flat stones, particularly around one side. We've got a little bit more to come off on one half of the site yet to complete that circle. But it's not just one circle or one D-shaped area of stone. There's other things going on in there as well. There's some areas where we've got upright stones, orthostats, what we call orthostats, where they've been set stones upright to make divisions between things. We're just starting to pick up on another line of stones around the outside of the building, which we're not sure what that's for yet. We're just below the surface, I think. A bit like the fish in the loch that we can see out the window. So I think John's not too disappointed that he's lost his stone circle. I'm not too disappointed that I have lost my curb cairn, although we still got this interesting feature in the middle. You know, these buildings were quite often built one on top of something else, so I've not completely given up that there might be something earlier underneath the central feature that seems to relate directly to what we're calling a building now. Yeah, until we get to the bottom, we won't know.
Looking back at the geophysics, though, the thing that struck me most about that was the geometric perfection of the circle. Are you saying that it's not looking quite so much like an absolutely perfect geometric circle anymore?
It's more D-shaped.
That's odd.
I mean, it's just because one side of the circle is slightly flatter than the other bits, but it's still, I mean, John is really quite pleased because now we're sort of uncovering more of it. It does seem to confirm a fairly circular shape around that. It's still going around that central feature. It's just one side seems slightly straighter than the others is. He's been going around this morning, I think, just sort of checking out which stones that we can now see match up with what he's got on his geophysics. And he seemed quite pleased that there was a match up. But I think we've just got slightly more activity on one side than we could see in the one. We only saw one slice, don't forget, of that geophysics. We only saw it captured at one depth level. And it's slightly more complicated because some of the stones are at a slightly deeper level and some are slightly higher. So he's a happy bunny. He was quite happy that things were matching up and where he got odd, because he had gaps. He had quite a lot of gaps, if you remember. It wasn't continuous, which is why he thought it was a stone circle.
So it may be the human brain that's putting in that perfection of the curve.
Yeah, and it is a complete curve. We've got one little bit where it looks to have been robbed out for maybe, you know, a metre and a half. But we have got certainly at least around one half, probably three quarters of it, a complete row of circular row of stones.
Well, we are going to hear from John. I think in a couple of weeks' time, we're going to make sure we grill him on all of this stuff because we do need to know the answers.
Thank you so much, Jackie, for coming in out of the cold and the rain and even taking your waterproofs off to speak to us. You'll have to pile them back on again, I think, now going outside. What's the weather like?
Well, no, it's not too bad. I don't think... Oh, I'm tempting fate here. I'm holding on some wood. I don't think it's going to rain again this afternoon, just a bit later on. And the wind is nowhere near as violent as it was yesterday. It was really quite a windy day. It's nice digging weather, actually.
Good.
Nice digging weather.
Well, have a lovely afternoon. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us and giving us an update. And we'll hear more.
All right. Cheerio.
This is the Time Scene Podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. Here I am at the Ness of Brodgar in my kind of kitchen base where all the archaeologists are occasionally walking in to make themselves a cup of tea and grab a biscuit or something like that after they've been out in the cold and the rain. But there's other things, of course, going on besides what's happening here at the Ness of Brodgar. And right now on YouTube, you can watch a classic episode of Time Team called Jamestown, America's Birthplace.
Yes, now Jamestown was the first place in North America to be successfully colonised by the English. We made the episode in, I think it was 2006, and I was lucky enough to be part of it all, both the historical research that we did in the UK and some of the actual digging on site, including the waterlogged well deposits, which produced some of the remarkable finds that you can see in the film.
Well, work is still going on to uncover more about Jamestown and the people who made it their home. So let's catch up with progress by speaking to Sean Romo, Jamestown Rediscovery's Director of Archaeology. Sean, really, really good to speak to you. How are you? How is it in Jamestown at the moment?
Well, it's a little bit rainy here today, but we've had a great summer of excavation, and I'm really feeling great to be on the program. Thank you guys for having me on here.
Oh, that is a pleasure. Are there still people there, by the way, who remember Time Team's visit back in 2006? Because I'm sure you're too young.
I missed it by a few years. But we do have people on staff. My colleague Mariana Hartley, who is one of the co-runners of the archaeology team, she was here way back when. She's in the background of a lot of the shots on the video. Some of my other colleagues in the lab, like Dan Gamble, were also around when you were all filming. So there is some continuity with the last visit.
Sean, I can imagine that there's enough archaeology at Jamestown to keep you going for decades. But what work has gone on since we filmed there? What new have you found out about it?
We were really focusing a lot on James Fort, right? On that initial settlement, what was going on within the fort walls. In the recent years, we've realized that there's a lot more to uncover beyond those palisades and stuff that does date back to 1607, 1608. We've also had to kind of pivot in that direction because we're facing pretty severe impacts from flooding. You know, sea levels have risen quite a lot in the last 100 years, and it's become an acute issue for us here. So we're using a combination of ground-penetrating radar and excavation to get out into these low-lying spaces off the hill and really dig into kind of the other parts of Jamestown history.
I remember the palisade as being this triangle which makes you feel very secure within the reconstructed fence. Outside, though, I was aware that that's where the growing of tobacco began and so on. Do you mean that the palisade was not the only space that was occupied right at the start, that they were already beginning to go beyond their kind of bridgehead?
That's absolutely right. And if you look back on some of the original maps of Jamestown and Virginia, like the one that John Smith drew in 1608, you know, he draws the triangular fort, right, that palisade you saw, but he also draws a little extension that looks like a flag going to the north. And just in the last few years, we've proved that that actually really is an archaeological feature on the ground. It's a massive military fortification that is a ditch. It looks an awful lot like a World War I trench with a drain in the bottom and everything, but it is definitively from 1608. It's pretty clear to us that the English, they expanded outside that triangular palisade as soon as they could.
They were deliberately using military techniques then, because, of course, one of the things that was so interesting about the well and the finds that came out of that was the number of weapons that there were there. I mean, why would you get rid of a halberd or a pistol down a well if you were still needing it because you were in conflict with the original inhabitants? I'm really interested to hear that, because trying to get your head around how they were interacting with the Native Americans there is quite a tricky thing. The next one is the well, which with all these strange weapons in it. But then that flag type area was actually an archaeological thing. I mean, that was part of the, well, I don't know if it still is, but that was certainly part of the, almost the branding of the Jamestown excavation, wasn't it? You saw on everybody's T-shirts the triangle with the flag. And I just assumed that John Smith had drawn it as a kind of, well, literally a flag, but it's a real thing.
A lot of people thought exactly that it was symbolic. When we adopted it for our logo, which we still use, yeah, we didn't know what it was. And Bill Kelso, right, the first director of archaeology, he did go looking for it, but he didn't have the added benefit of ground-penetrating radar. Ultimately, when we did uncover it, he was only about 5 feet off of where it was.
Oh, how annoying.
I know. I think he probably would have loved to have uncovered this. But when we were experimenting with ground-penetrating radar, we wanted to target some of these outer areas. And Bill's successor and my predecessor as director of archaeology, Dave Gibbons, he was really interested in using ground-penetrating radar to analyze these spaces. And we saw this ditch extending out from that north bulwark, that curved fortification at the peak of James Fort, off kilter. And immediately he looked at the symbol on our shirt and said, if you look at the drawing that John Smith did, that flag is off kilter in the exact same way. And so when we started to expand out there and actually excavate, we were able to trace it and prove this is 1608.
My goodness.
With the arms and armor that were being found, that well you were looking at, that's probably from 1610, 1611, and filled in a little bit later. And what we've found as we've excavated in other wells or in other early features is that we do see arms and armor discarded. And often those are because the English colonists have been forced to adapt. They're here in the Virginia heat wearing heavy metal armor that is slowing them down, you know, getting shot at with bows and arrows, and they decide it's really not worth it. Or they make a modification to some of that material. You know, there's one really interesting breastplate that's got a modification to allow you to shoulder a musket. And that's something that's really only seen here in Virginia because it was not common practice. It was not standard to do that. But they're adapting to the needs of warfare in the New World.
It's so amazing to imagine these colonists turning up, having never experienced the New World before and just starting afresh, setting up completely. I will say, though, Sean, that I know that archaeologists here in the UK would probably consider what you do fairly modern archaeology, and maybe in the US it's regarded as, you know, almost ancient history just because of the times that European settlers arrived. How does doing archaeology in the US compare to what you know about how it works elsewhere?
Well, you're right about the different timescales. Famously, there's been a disagreement between British archaeologists and American archaeologists about the value of plow zone, right? And those upper levels of soil and the time we take to excavate that. What we have in the United States is a perception that Jamestown is ancient history because for many people, they don't think about the really, really deep history of North America going back thousands and thousands and thousands of years because there's been, you know, Native Americans living in North America for a really long time. But many people start thinking about the birthplace of the United States. They start thinking about Jamestown, and that's where they actually trace the history from. So depending on your perspective, even in America, what we're looking at is relatively modern. But for many people, they consider it, yeah, that very beginning.
I was really struck rewatching the program that we made it almost entirely from the point of view of the English colonists. I've wondered ever since, really, have there been changes in how the Native Americans are represented at Jamestown now? I suppose not just in the way that the site presents itself, but I suppose, do you think that we would have made that program really differently if we were making it today?
Yes, I do think we would have maybe chosen some different words and taken a slightly different tactic on it. One of the things we try to emphasize here when we're doing, you know, public tours and public programs is that it wasn't that the English arrived and a switch was flipped and this was Virginia. This was Senecomica. There are people already living here. And the English colonists know they are invading somebody else's territory because the Virginia Company, when they send them over, give them rules for where to pick a spot to settle. And some of those rules are predicated on not upsetting the Powhatan, the people who already are here, because they don't want a war. You know, looking back on things that had happened in the late 1500s, Spain had actually tried to colonize what became Virginia and North Carolina on the east coast of the United States in the late 1500s. And in both cases, they were evicted by the native population that was living here. You know, the English would have been aware, at least a little bit, of those issues. And definitely came in with the mindset of, okay, we're looking for gold, we're looking for riches, we're looking for power. We don't want to start a fight we can't win right away. We actually see that when the first colonists start to die, they're buried inside the walls of James Fort to hide the deaths so as not to show any weakness. Of course, the starving time, you know, the winter of 1609 and 1610, part of the reason that happens is that the English pick a fight with the Powhatan that they're losing. And so they're actually trapped inside James Fort, which makes the opportunity to get food from the river or from hunting non-existent. So you do see a different narrative emerge when you're looking at what the Powhatan are doing. You know, they're trying to maintain their, you know, sovereignty, their integrity. They're trading with the English at first, it seems like, to try to actually bring them into the tributary system that already exists over here. Famously, John Smith's capture and being saved at the last minute. That's Wahoon Seneca, or Chief Powhatan, as we more commonly know him, showing John Smith who's boss, telling him, hey, you live and die by my hand because you're in my land. So I think we probably would have taken a slightly different approach if we were filming it these days. One of the things we try to do more now is a balance. The origins of modern America go back to that English colony. And that is absolutely a major story to tell because it's a huge part of our history, of world history, right? Of British history. But we want to make sure that we're balancing out by talking about the native peoples who are already here, talking about the Powhatan, talking about Wahun Seneca, talking about the three wars that the English fight with them, talking about the Siouan-speaking and Iroquoian-speaking peoples that are in the western part of what becomes Virginia. It's not a straightforward thing, right? The English come here, they grow out, they eventually take over the Powhatan territory, but they're trading with and dealing with other groups. And in fact, one of the major anniversaries this year not only has been the American Revolution, but Bacon's Rebellion in 1676. Nathaniel Bacon was a wealthy planter who was living in the western part of Virginia and started a rebellion against the governor here at Jamestown and the crown generally. In fact, marched on Jamestown and burned it to the ground. And the whole reason he did that was that he was unhappy. He couldn't seize more Native American territory because the government had signed agreements with the tribes in the western part of the state. He's a pretty mixed figure in American history because this revolution is very much on a bad footing. It's a bad reason to do this. But the way he gets an army is that he promises enslaved African Americans, enslaved Africans, and indentured servants their freedom if they march with them. You know, a lot of past scholars have said, you know, this is almost a trial run for the American Revolution, different reasons, but it grew out of the English Civil War and it shows that you can depose a government, you can challenge things. When we're talking about the full run of Virginia history, there's a lot of nuance there.
Yeah, gosh, it's fascinating.
It really is fascinating, isn't it? And there's so much to still learn by the sounds of it. Sounds like you got your work cut out for you, Sean. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us about it. Really appreciate your time.
I've been feeling really jealous of you, Martin, being in Orkney for this month. But going to Jamestown was one of the most memorable experiences of my whole life. It really is massively worth a visit.
I bet. If you want to watch that YouTube video, by the way, it's gone up not too long ago. You can go and see it now. Well worth a watch. Just search for Jamestown Time Team on YouTube and you will find it. Sean, thank you very much.
Yes, thanks, Sean.
Thanks to you both.
There have been quite a number of visitors on site there at the Nessa Brodgar, haven't there, Martin?
Yeah, I mean, there have. I mean, there's been loads and loads of tourists who keep coming past. Every now and again, there's a coachload of people. But there's been some famous faces as well. So, Sir Tony Robinson, he was here a few days ago. I recorded a couple of interviews with him, actually, one of which you might have already seen on the Dig Watch, which went out to Time Team members on Patreon a few weeks ago. The other one you can see in here on a future edition of the podcast. That's going to be available to watch on YouTube. I think I'm going to put that out in about 2 weeks' time, something like that.
And I'm quite interested to hear from another famous face who was around the other day, Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words, who makes videos about language and etymology. He was also visiting. And Martin, you know how much I enjoy that subject, so I'm particularly keen to hear what he's been getting up to on Orkney and what his impressions of the area have been.
It's an amazing place with a history like none other, a sort of unsung hero of European history, really, isn't it? You have not only these amazing Stone Age sites, but you've also got this Norse, this Viking story running through the place names here and also just in the signs and the way people talk. It's an amazing place.
We'll get on to exactly what you're doing whilst you're here in a moment, but first, to be at a Time Team dig, I mean, how does that feel?
It's absolutely bizarre. It's wonderful because I was watching Time Team from when I was wee. And to actually be at a dig, seeing some of the people that I've been watching on television all this time, including Sir Tony, is just marvellous.
You are here with, a slight ulterior motive in that you are looking at some of the language that has been spoken and is spoken on Orkney. What have you been discovering then?
So I've been here trying to find out more about Norn, which is a language that I don't think many people outside of these islands and Shetland have necessarily heard of, but it's a Scandinavian language that was once spoken here. Yeah, Britain had its own Scandinavian language, but it's been lost to time. Norn was a language that was not really written down. It was never the language of administration here, despite it being for a time the dominant language here. But because these islands have changed hands between the Norwegians and the Scots and the Danes over the centuries, they've used the languages of Old Norse, of Norwegian, of Danish and Scots as their administrative languages. Norn never got a look in. And as a result, we have barely any written record of it, just a few attempts to write it down in the 1700s where people just listened to what Norn speakers were saying and then noting it down as best they could. But even then, these aren't necessarily reliable records of what this language truly sounded like.
At the site, we are surrounded by Neolithic history. Do we know what language would have been spoken here 4,000, 5,000 years ago?
Well, it definitely wouldn't have been Norn, because that was spoken some 4,000 years after the buildings that you've been excavating are thought to have been constructed. I'll tell you this, we have no idea what the people who built those buildings spoke. We have no idea what their language was like. Was it one related to ours? Was it from the same language family as in the Indo-European language family? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it was something completely different. Indo-European languages make up almost all of the languages in Europe, and it spread largely because of the spread of farming. And we know that the buildings that you're finding on Orkney are a result of the spread of farming, of people laying down roots. And they, you know, they're some of the earliest buildings that the farmers that end up populating all of Europe put up are these buildings that you're finding in Orkney. But we don't know when they were building them and they were saying, pass me that rock. We don't know how they were saying it.
I really like the fact that you are here, because it's proved a theory that Helen and I have had for a while, that there is a big crossover between Time Team fans and fans of your channel. And earlier on, someone I saw came up to you, and I think it was All Their Christmases at Once, because not only was Sir Tony Robinson standing there, so were you. And I don't think people can quite compute it. Why is there, do you think, this crossover? Because I'm sure it exists between people who love history and archaeology and people who love what you do, etymology.
Well, what do we have in common? We try to explain the past in the most comprehensible way and the most fun way. And people appreciate that, I hope. It's hard to answer the question without sounding a little arrogant, but I can say I can say what Time Team does very well, and it makes history easy. And people really appreciate that, because they want to know about their past, but they can't necessarily find their way through the academic language. But Time Team helps you find a way through.
Oh, that's really lovely. I mean, Rob Words also helps you find a way through, really, doesn't it? It makes history easy for those who are interested in the language side of it. You don't get much of the stuff on the velar fricatives and the great vowel shift. You get an easy guide through what's so fascinating, and it's all different building blocks of how we understand the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was really great to see just how enthusiastic he was getting about the same things that I know you would be getting enthusiastic about, Helen, and I was as well.
Yeah.
Just, you know, watching the archaeologists uncover more and more and more here at the Ness of Brodgar. And he was just so eager to kind of find out as much as he could about the work that's been going on. So
I
will be watching with great intrigue his YouTube channel to find out what videos might be released in the next little while that feature the Time Team dig.
Yes, I will be too, yes.
But I think that's probably about it from us on the Time Team podcast for this week. I shall love you and leave you from the Ness of Brodgar and my little kitchen office that I've set up here in this rather strange building. It does have to be said, Helen. It's a sort of a bungalow, which is an odd thing to have at a Neolithic site, isn't it? Just right next to an archaeology thing. But because it's where archaeologists work, every corner, every corridor, every area of this bungalow is just full of like boxes of finds, all marked up in black marker pen. And then there's somebody's desk, and then next to that there's just a bit of rock that somebody's dealing with, and then there's a magnifying glass. So it's very much an archaeologist's bungalow. You very much feel like you're part of that. But a lovely place to spend a little while, I will say. Back next week with more of the answers to the questions that you've been asking. If you're a Time Team member, I had loads and loads of questions on the Ness of Brodgar. We are going to put them to the people who know the most about this site, and that's the site directors. Last week, you remember, it was Nick Card, where you're going to be hearing from another site director next week. Anne Mitchell is going to be joining us and answering some of your questions. So that's something to look forward to.
Absolutely, yes. I can't wait to hear more. But for now, from us, it's goodbye.
Bye-bye.